Welcome to this podcast from Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. This podcast is made possible through support from the members of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about events or membership, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum or join us on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I am David Batstone, a professor of ethics at the University of San Francisco and the co-founder of the Not for Sale campaign. Tonight we're talking with Kerry Kennedy. Since 1981, Kennedy has worked as a human rights activist, established the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Human Rights in 1988, chaired the Amnesty International Leadership Council, and has worked to address the problems of social justice through urban and political activism. In Kerry's most recent book, Being Catholic Now, she discusses what it means to be Catholic in the 21st century and addressing how to reconcile her faith with the changing times. Tonight we will talk about the evolution of religious thinking and its place in a modern era, and please join me in welcoming Kerry Kennedy. So Kerry, this new book, Being Catholic Now, it comes as a refreshing and also maybe a bit of an extraordinary book for someone who works in human rights and progressive social justice causes. Maybe a book called Being Spiritual Now, or you know, Being in Tune with the Universe, or something of that nature. But Being Catholic Now, I mean, that's a real tough one in the circles you run in, isn't it?
Well, not really. You know, I grew up in a very traditional Catholic family, where we got up every morning and consecrated the day through the Immaculate Heart of Mary to our Lord Jesus. And we prayed before and after breakfast, lunch, and dinner. After dinner, we read the Bible aloud. And before we went to bed at night, we prayed the rosary around my parents' bed. I think that was pretty typical of the 1960s. I have, and then in my household, there were a lot of nuns and priests. And my parents were very involved. My parents are Bobby and Ethel Kennedy, very involved in civil rights issues here in the United States and internationally. And so we were surrounded by these wonderful, very socially progressive Catholics who were involved in these issues, anti-poverty issues in Watts, the Mississippi Delta, the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, all around our country and, again, around the world. As a human rights activist for the last 27 years, I've had the most extraordinary privilege of witnessing the bravery of Catholics who are imbued by their faith to stand up to government oppression, face imprisonment, torture, and death for basic rights. The solidarity activists in Poland, the Mothers of the Disappeared, along with Archbishop Romero in El Salvador, more recently Archbishop Michael Francis in Liberia. And these are, so to me, being Catholic and working on social justice issues are really one and the same.
Hey, you know, when we look at your mother, Ethel, and your father, Robert, you know, it was reminded when I was seeing the movie Bobby, and they were giving some of your father's speeches. What unbelievable speeches. It's something we forget, just someone could speak like that in public life in America. But I think probably for most Americans, they saw the Kennedy clan as culturally Catholic and then politically justice, but the two of them maybe didn't bridge in the popular mind, but obviously in the home, those were of the same fabric.
Absolutely. And I think that this is, in talking to so many people who, in the book, it's got 37 interviews with famous Americans. I found that again and again, people's faith and their work on social justice were pretty much one and the same. Donna Brazile, who grew up in New Orleans, talked about that and her the struggle for civil rights in her community and how tied it was to the Catholic Church. And then, of course, San Francisco's Nancy Pelosi, talked about growing up. She grew up, of course, in Baltimore. Her father was the mayor, and she had five older brothers. But she talked about the importance of Catholicism, in her case being Italian-American, being part of the Democratic Party and working on justice issues.
Now, both you and Speaker Pelosi went to Sacred Heart Convent schools, is that right?
That's and right.
I'm wondering what kind of influence, yes, we have some Sacred Heart Convent folks in the audience and, shouting out to you that great tradition. What role did that have in your own kind of formation?
Well, I think this was important for me because I grew up in a family in a country where males dominated and where males were favored over girls and women. And here I was in a Catholic school, all girls, all taught by nuns, where women were mighty and women were in charge and women were making the decisions. And there was this extraordinary sort of moral certitude among many of the people there. We had a fabulous mother superior called Mother Mouton, and they had a rule at Sacred Heart that you weren't allowed to talk in the halls, and I was always talking in the halls. So I was always being sent to Mother Mouton, and she would, every time I went to see her, she would give me a lollipop and tell me that Jesus loves me no matter how I misbehave, and ask me about the war in Vietnam. And, and you know, sort of condemn the war and ask me about my parents. And one time she said to me, you know, Carrie, just remember that silence is golden, but sometimes it's just plain yellow. And so, you know, I really remember her sort of, again, that sort of activism in the community and that urgent need to be involved and to know what's going on in our country and the wider world.
So at that Catholic high school, you had a voice, and you found the power of being a woman and speaking out for justice. I have so many friends who are Catholic women who then graduated from high school, went out into the world and said, you know, in the Catholic Church, we have no voice, we're marginalized. How is it that you found a home there? Because so many retreat from it. How is it you found, you still find an identity and a rooting there?
Yeah, well, let me just clarify. I was at the Convent of the Sacred Heart, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th grade.
Oh, okay.
And I went to this very hippy-dippy high school in Vermont called Putney School, which is wonderful, wonderful school, but had absolutely nothing to do with being Catholic. And I think, you know, for me, I have felt incredibly frustrated with the church, particularly on the issue of women's empowerment. At the same time, I've been so deeply inspired by women like Mother Mouton and Sister Joan Chittister and so many others, Sister Helen Prejean, who, of course, works on the death penalty, and again on these extraordinary women, the Mary Knollers in El Salvador and Guatemala and all around the world who have taken up these issues. So I kind of feel inspired by them. And when I have an argument with the church, I'm able to separate my my frustration with the bishops or the pope or the local Catholic priest and my relationship with the Almighty.
You have three daughters, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Do you raise them in the Catholic Church? Is that something that's important for you?
Yeah, absolutely. We go to church on Sunday. I have taught them CCD, and they go to CCD every week, and you know, and we pray, and so after every meal, et cetera. But it's different from the way I was brought up, and I'll give you an example of this. When my youngest daughter was 6 years old, she was in CCD. She came home. CCD is Catholic religious education. It's like Sunday school. And so she came home one day, and she said, Mom, my teacher doesn't know anything. She can't answer my questions. And I said, really? Well, what did you ask her? And she said, well, she taught us to say Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. And I said, why are we saying Father and not Mother? Because God could be a girl. And then I said, and why do we have to say son? I mean, it could have been a daughter. It happened to be a son. Why don't we just say child? And she said, and she couldn't answer my question. Now, these are not questions that occurred to me in the 1960s.
Yeah, well, so she's a remarkable, critical thinking young woman.
Well, you know, I mean, and having taught CCD, I find that she's not unique. This is typical of that generation. They're asking questions, which I think is part of what Catholicism is all about. You know, when Pope Benedict was here last spring in the United States, he said that one of the pillars of Catholicism is searching for the truth. And I think that that's really what the church has taught a whole generation of people in this country, several generations. And Catholics are now searching for the truth, and they're asking questions, and sometimes those are tough questions.
You know, just yesterday I came back from the Philippines where I was doing some investigation on anti-trafficking of women and children, the buying and selling of human beings. And, you know, obviously the Philippines is a very Catholic country. And the thing that really strikes me whenever I go, you know, the Philippines or El Salvador, wherever, is that on the one hand, there's this, almost this pietism, this Catholic pietism, which almost controls and keeps people in line, not to question or not to challenge. On the other hand, the people who are doing the best justice work, the best human rights work, people who are challenging the authorities, are also those who are inspired by their Catholic faith. How do you account for that kind of very strange polarization?
Well, I think you're right, and that it does sort of, you know, the thing about Catholicism is there's all of these mixed messages all the time. Christ has died, but Christ is coming. Christ is the Father, and Christ is the, you know, God is the Father, and Christ is the Father, and Christ is the Son at the same time. It's very mixed up. And then Catholics sort of say, you know, please explain this. And then the priests say, you know, go in peace. And so I think in a way this is a strength for us Catholics, because life is full of contradictions and mysteries and things that don't really make any sense. And so, you know, when you're most in love, you're also most vulnerable and fearful. And when you are most angry at injustice, it's also an opportunity to create change out of that anger. And so I think that Catholicism, in a way, prepares us for the contradictions and complexities of life in general.
Yeah. Speaking of being Catholic now, you know, you probably could just as easily have written a memoir about your own spiritual journey through the Catholic faith, but you chose to write a series of interviews with other public figures. So I'm wondering about that choice, because you could have gone either way. Why did you go the interview route?
Well, I actually did include in the book a chapter on my own spiritual experience and my own spiritual journey. But, you know, I was really struggling at this point time when I started to write this book, because Catholicism was part of my outlook, my faith, my connection to the Almighty, my heritage. And then at the same time, I felt this incredible disconnect with so much of the church. I was for 8 years in a Northern Virginia parish where the parish priest would not allow girls to be altar servers. And it was one of two archdioceses in the country that didn't allow. Now they've changed, but at that point they didn't. And he would get up there, not allow my girls to be altar servers, and then rail against women for the only sin that only women can commit. And then it's the height of the pedophile scandals and everything else. So I just felt that I misperceived my anger and frustration at some of the members of the institutional church as preventing me from being in touch with the Almighty and with the community of believers. And so I really felt that it was important to resolve that issue. And what I did is I want to talk to other Catholics about how they feel about it. And what I found is that everybody has an argument with the church. The most orthodox, Tom Monahan, who started Domino's Pizza and started this kind of Catholic utopia society, in his eyes, utopian society in Florida, has an argument with the church. Father Bob Drynan had an argument with the church. All the nuns I talked to have an argument with the church. Every person from the most orthodox to most lax have an argument with the church. And I think that the church is kind of organized so we do have arguments with it.
You know, as a writer, it's really tough to choose what you're going to invest your life into, because it is, like, anyone who's a writer knows how much effort it takes to write a book. So why this book? I mean, you've got the Human Rights Center. I mean, you're involved in so many important things. Why write a book about Catholicism today? Why was that something that was worthy of your investment, you know, in your life?
Well, you know, one of the people I interviewed for the book is a woman called Kiki Kennedy, and she is actually married to my cousin, Ted Kennedy Jr., and she grew up in a Jewish family, and she teaches psychiatry at Yale Medical School. And she converted when she was in her mid-40s at the height of the pedophile scandal. And in the answer to your question, what she said is, I always took my faith for granted, and I just assumed it would be there. And I realized at a certain point that I wanted my faith to be more central to my life, and I wanted it to be there for me. And I realized that if I wanted that faith to be important, that I was going to have to invest in it. And so I kind of feel the same way, that I wanted that faith to be richer, deeper, more meaningful in my life, and I realized I was going to have to work on it.
You know, having the great pleasure to spend a few minutes with you in the green room before it came out, I discovered that you were not as deadly earnest as the topic might lead one to believe. So the question is, there must be some funny moments that came out in this book and these interviews around people talking about serious stuff.
Well, there were, of course. You know, I was mentioning Nancy Pelosi, who I adore, earlier, and she's hilariously funny in this book, but she said that she grew up, you know, her mother always wanted her to be a nun, and she said that her mother would, when she'd come home from school, her mother didn't say, did you score a goal or did you get an A, but were you holy today? And she said that, I said to her, well, did you want to be a nun? And she said, no, I want to be a priest. She said, you know, the nuns were wonderful, but the priest held all the power. And then Susan Sarandon has this fabulous story of when she was 7 years old and her aunt gave her glow-in-the-dark rosary beads, which she didn't realize were glow-in-the-dark. And so she turned off her lights that night and got under her covers, and they start to glow, and she thought, oh, my God, I'm going to see a revelation. And then when I talked to, I asked a lot of the people in the book, what would you do if you were Pope? And when I asked that of Cardinal McCarrick, he said, I'd resign right away and get a good guy in there. So, you know, so there was a lot of this throughout the book. And, of course, someone like Dan Aykroyd just tells one story after the other, which kind of made me fall on the floor laughing. So it was a great experience.
And how did you come up with this list of participants? How did you find them, or why did you choose them?
Well, I wanted a diversity. I wanted a balance of men and women. I wanted a diversity of age groups, so it's 19 to 86. And I wanted a diversity of political background, so it's, you know, Bill O'Reilly to Nancy Pelosi. I wanted the orthodox Tom Monahan to lax or, you know, rejecting religion altogether, like Bill Maher. And then I wanted a diversity of backgrounds. So there's historians like Doris Kearns Goodwin and Doug Brinkley, politicians, actors, you know, a wide range of people.
So Bill O'Reilly and Bill Maher, did either of them say anything that surprised you? Did anything come out in the interview that you didn't expect? Or?
Well, the thing that I didn't expect in a lot of the people, like Bill O'Reilly and Peggy Noonan and Andrew Sullivan, who, you know, usually when they appear on TV, I'm yelling at the TV because we don't agree on anything. And what I found is that they, when they were talking about their experience as Catholics, that I really related to them on a very deep and essential level. You know, Andrew Sullivan is talked about being Catholic and growing up in England and being teased for being Catholic and how he held fast to his faith, because it was something that he was being teased about. So I think that that's kind of interesting and and he talks about his arguments with the church and how it's, he says, it's important when I disagree with the Pope, and that I, particularly on the whole issue of homosexuality and love, he talks about how he went and did the research and looked into what the Vatican says on it and argued on their level about it, which I think is very interesting.
When I was looking at some of the demographics of voting in America around elections, white Catholic voters tend to vote very socially conservative in terms of informing their vote, by and large. And that, obviously, that's not where you arrive at being informed by your faith. I'm just wondering where that, you know, how, what informs the white Catholic voter in America? It's a range, but what informs that? And maybe it came out in the course of looking at your book. When I come from faith to public life, from faith to ethics, how I live my life, what informs that? And how is that connected or disconnected for me?
Yeah, I think you raise a very interesting point because, you know, in right now, about 40% of the American electorate are Catholic, and many of those can go either way, Democratic or Republican. In the 1960 election, when President Kennedy, first Catholic to become president, ran, he got about 100% of the Catholic vote, a huge, huge, huge majority of it. But under Reagan, a lot of the Catholics went and voted on the Republican side, and in recent elections, they go both ways. So what is that about? I think there's been the Catholic Church in the United States there's a disconnect between what it says and what it actually does. And what it actually does is it's the largest provider of education outside of government, and it's the largest provider of health care outside of government, and it's one of the largest social services organizations to the poor in America outside of government. So that's what it does. But if you ask Catholics, or if you ask especially somebody who's not a Catholic, what does the Catholic Church stand for, they'll tell you abortion. You know, and they won't talk about the social justice piece of it. And so I think that we've really failed as a church to talk about those issues at the pulpit and make them important in people's lives.
As you've traveled around the globe and you're, you know, just a cursory look at your background shows that you've been a lot of places, and many here would like to share your frequent flyer miles. But I'm wondering, what have you learned about Catholicism globally? That, you know, we talk about American Catholicism, and we talk about Catholicism globally. Is there something that you took away from your experiences going around the world, connecting with the Catholic Church, that you learned about the Church Universal, the Church Global?
Well, I think that, you know, again, my experience has been all in international human rights, and so most of the Catholics who I actually have worked with overseas are sort of on the cutting edge of social change, and they have been tremendously courageous and really living the social justice message of the Church. In a way that we aren't so challenged to do when we're comfortable in America. Middle-class America, in a way, is not it's not quite the same as being under a dictatorship and having your life threatened by the government on a daily basis. Mm. So I think that's kind of a different way of expressing faith.
Mm. I have to ask this, but how does a Catholic American woman look at the Pope? How do you relate to the magisterium in terms of how you live your life and it's your relationship to understanding your theology and your beliefs and practice?
Well, you know, when I interviewed Bob Drynan, Father Bob Drynan, he said, "This is a fallible church made up of fallible men, and we can." And John Paul II apologize for 92 bad things the church has done over the last millennia, and we can expect more of the same. So I don't get too worked up when people say things or do things that I disagree with. I just sort of dismiss that and focus on what I think is important, the important message of this faith, which is that we should love God. We have a loving and just God. We should love God, and we should love one another. And that's the essential message of Catholicism, search for the truth. And look at Jesus as the embodiment of that love. I think that that's kind of it. And when they get in the way of that, I just think that they're mistaken, and they'll figure that out eventually, and I'm going to focus on what's important. But I actually, you know, I think that there were a lot of us who were very fearful when Pope Benedict was named. And he, in fact, has I mean, in my view, which is limited, of what he's done, I think he's done a great job. You know, his first letter was about love, very, very positive message. When he came to the United States, he made an enormous effort to reach out and to address the pedophile scandal in a way that the bishops in this country had really failed to do. There's that whole controversy about academia, and he talked about the importance of searching for the truth and not being completely orthodox in what academics might be doing here. So I think that all in all, he's done a very good job.
You know, I grew up in the Midwest in a fundamentalist evangelical church, so you weren't even going to heaven in my world because you were a Catholic. And so it was very, it's funny now, teaching at a Jesuit school, it's the great revenge. But what I'm curious about is that from those, you know, 1960 when John F. Kennedy was the president, was running, the divide between evangelicals and Catholics in terms of identity. Today, that's a very blurred line. I mean, there's a lot of alliances and a lot of enemies. You know, it's just much, it's very postmodern, you might call it, but it's very mixed. I'm just wondering your connection to non-Catholic Christians, evangelicals, and other Protestants. Is there kind of a connection that you have that, you know, when you go around talking, I'm sure people come up to you who are not Catholic and say, I really am inspired by your book. What's your connection to the non-Catholic Christian community?
Well, there's a difference between the non-Catholic Christian community and the who are Orthodox and who are not. So I think that most of what I have done with my life and most of my views are more palatable to the people who aren't as Orthodox, probably both Catholics and non-Catholics. And as far as what's my connection to Orthodox Christians, I don't have a strong connection to Orthodox Christians in general. Although, again, I mean, one of the lessons that I learned in writing this book and in speaking to people who have very, you know, a wide range of visions and views towards Catholicism is that I felt very connected in surprising ways to those who were Orthodox or who are Orthodox. You know, somebody, again, like Tom Monahan, who described growing up in an orphanage, very, very strict orphanage, in which he had to scrub the floor of the church every day. And he said he would scrub it for 2 hours, and then the nuns would come in and inspect it and say, okay, now start again. And he'd scrub it for another 2 hours, and they'd say, okay, now start again. And he did that 6 hours one day, and the next morning they'd say, okay, now go scrub the floor. And that's what his life was like for years and years and years. And he said, you know, I couldn't wait to get out of that place, but I felt so blessed to be in the presence of the consecrated host, of the Blessed Sacrament. And I understand that. I understand that feeling of connectedness and of the joy of being near Christ. Mm-hmm.
And so does ritual, which you call the communion, the celebration of the Mass. Do those rituals still resonate with you? They don't seem outdated or alien, but they resonate with you?
No, absolutely. They do very much resonate with me. And I love that. I love the smell of the candles. I love the incense. I love the majesty of the church. I love all the costumes, the whole thing. I love all that.
Is that like in people's DNA? I mean, do some people like resonate with it and others say, I don't get it. How can that resonate with you? I mean, is this something you've always had? Like from being a little girl?
So.
I mean, have you always resonated with it? The mystery, the majesty?
I guess it was just, I always liked it. I feel very comfortable with that.
Now, a young person comes up to you, as they have to me as a professor, say, how in the world can you believe in a God in a world of torture, Speak Truth to Power, is your other book on human rights, in a world of suffering where so many people live in poverty? How can you believe in a God in that kind of world?
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of this suffering is caused by humans, not by God. That's what I think. Certainly torture and a lot of the death and destruction. And people say, oh, but what about Hurricane Katrina? Well, what about Hurricane Katrina? Why didn't we build up the levees? That was a man-made decision. Why didn't we send in the help that they need in New Orleans? Why have we still not helped people to return to their homes and to build their communities and to create their schools, et cetera? Those are what we do as human beings, and we make those decisions that condemn so many to suffering, and slavery is an issue that you've worked on for so long.
And so for those kinds of human dilemmas, you find that your faith gives you an inspiration and a reason, motivation, orientation to actually fight the injustice,
It does.
Evil.
It does. And then for the things that are not man-made, that are just seem unfair or wrong, I don't know. You know, when I was a kid, I think, of course, it's well known that my father, Bobby Kennedy, died when I was 8. And my uncle, of course, President Kennedy, died when I was 4. But there were, I'd say, 8 or 9 other people who were very, very close to me who died during that period before I was 11 or 12 years old. My grandfather, another uncle, my next-door neighbor, my mother's best friend, the woman who cooked the food in our house but lived with us. You know, so there's just an enormous amount of suffering and sadness and loss. And I grew up in a house where I was told by adults and where I saw adults deal with that. And they dealt with it by going to the church and by saying the rosary and the sense of peace and the sense of serenity that I witnessed was extraordinary. And I was also told in very concrete terms, your father is in heaven and he's blissfully happy and he's looking down on you and he's with all the angels and he's with his brother and they can't wait to see you again. It's going to be a wonderful day when you're there. And when I would go up in an airplane when I was a kid, I would look behind the clouds to see if I could see the angels. So to me, that's, I guess, because that was so much of my formation, that it seems very easy and natural now for me to feel that a sense of peace despite the suffering that I see around me, not to blame God for it. That's what I mean.
Yeah, well, both your father and your uncle were, you know, remarkable for the fact that on in heaven as it is on earth and on earth as it is in heaven, that they took that hopefulness to inject it into the human story. And so, you know, that seems to have come out of a background of the Kennedy tradition about their connection to a faith that's vibrant and connected both to heaven and earth. Is that something that they, in their own family, that they also were taught from little kids?
Absolutely. You know, President Kennedy famously said, on earth, let God's work must truly be our own. And that is, my grandmother, Rose Kennedy, was very, very devout. He and my father considered becoming a priest. My mother considered becoming a nun. So I think that was a very, very important part of their core and who they were and how they viewed the world.
When you see the future of the church and you look ahead, and based on these interviews, you got a real range of folks who gave you their input. Where do you see the Catholic Church headed? Where do you see it moving in 20 years? If you had to look,
20 years is a very short amount of time in the Catholic Church.
Yes, exactly. How about 150 years? Where do you see it in 150 years?
Another millennium. Yeah. I think that there are certain structural issues that the Catholic Church has to grapple with. One is the lack of priests and nuns in the future. One of the lessons of the pedophile scandal is that there are just basic management issues that the Catholic Church needs to implement about how to handle employees and how to have transparency in how money is brought in and how much is spent and why and where and to whom. So I think that I would hope that some of that is going to, or all of that will be addressed. I think eventually it's going to have to be addressed, although there's a lot of resistance to it. I would hope at a certain point that there's a change so that women and married people are allowed to be priests. I don't really see how they do it.
Yeah.
Without them in the next, I think it'll take a few generations, but I think that's what will happen.
You have a remarkable ability to both have very radical revolutionary hopes for the world, that people can treat each other with dignity and human rights, that people can live with peace rather than always fight wars, and also that change will come eventually if we keep working for it. And I admire the sense of patience. Well, 20 years is a very short time. Where does that come from? And how do you deal with that? How do you live in the middle of contradiction and have both kind of the determination to change things, but the patience to let them happen in their own due course? I mean, that's a hard balance.
I don't know. In my life, I've just seen such incredible radical change because of individuals standing up and taking hold of an issue and taking responsibility for it. When I started working in human rights in 1980, all of Latin America was under military dictatorships. Today, there's not one left standing. At the time, South Africa was at the height of apartheid repression. Today, that country has had a series of freely elected governments. All of Eastern Europe was under communism. Today, all of Eastern Europe is free. There's not a communist tyrant left standing. And there's so many more changes like that all around the world, in the Philippines and Vietnam and other places. And none of those changes happened because governments or militaries or big multinational corporations wanted them to. In fact, governments, militaries, and multinationals tried to stop them in almost every case. But it was because individuals created change, and small groups of people got together and said, this is wrong, and we're not going to stand for it, and we're going to create a more just and peaceful world. And they did it. I mean, they did it. So I've seen so much basic change in institutions, which were impossible. It was an impossible dream to think that these things could change. And so I think the Catholic Church is going to face the same changes, and it's going to change because we are – there's a billion of us. There's 60 million in the United States. We're just not going to stand for this. We're going to create change.
Is your prayer life a desert experience or an oasis experience?
It's a little of both. It depends on the day.
And is that something, is prayer life important to you?
It is. I belong to a wonderful church. I have to say, I was in a church a few miles from me, and I left church sort of every Sunday so mad and so frustrated. And then I went to another church, and fabulous, radical social justice priest, and he's, forever condemning the war in Iraq and talking about whatever because whatever's on the front pages of the newspapers, and he's wonderful. And we have a kind of a prayer service every morning, and I drop my kids off to school, and then I go to it as much as often as I can. And it really gives me the start of a day that is grounded and is sort of a sense of serenity and a sense of purpose, which helps me a lot.
Do your kids go to Catholic schools?
No, they go to the local public school.
Oh. You also went to a public high school then?
No, you
went to Hippie Dippie School.
Right.
And then you went to Brown University and then Boston College.
Law school, yeah.
Yeah. So the Jesuits at Boston College, have you found an affinity with Jesuits around the globe?
I have. I love the Jesuits. I mean, you got to love Jesuits. They're so radical and wonderful and revolutionary. Almost everywhere you go, you can, you know, I always tell people if they're frustrated with their local church, just go find St. Ignatius. And if you find St. Ignatius in your community, you're going to be happy because they're just fantastic.
Yes, my kids go to St. Ignatius High School here in the city.
Oh, see, that's a good one. And you teach, right?
Yeah,
San
exactly.
Francisco.
Exactly. And, you know, I don't know if they don't realize that everybody in the world doesn't follow the St. Ignatius path for a living. I mean, they'll probably realize that when they get out. But it is a wonderful path for self-reflection and also the way it's lived out in so many expressions in the world. I can see your affinity for that. Tell me, what's your, in terms of all the human rights and social justice things in the world today, I'm sure there's some things that really grab your attention where you see yourself devoting your time to in the next few years. What is it that really grabs your passion right now?
Well, I think the human rights issue, which affects every human being on earth, is the repression of women. And I think that if we can solve that issue, then a lot of the other human rights abuses around the world will disappear. I mean, we were talking earlier about slavery. Most of the people who are enslaved, of course, are women. And then boys who are enslaved because their mothers can't take care of them. Their fathers have abandoned them for one reason or another. So if we can address this issue internationally, one out of every three women is sexually assaulted during her lifetime. In the United States, one out of every five women is sexually assaulted before she reaches the age of 21. In this country, Native American women and Native Alaskan women, one out of every three of them is raped in her lifetime. These are horrendous issues. And that is all reflected in other types of discrimination, like equal pay for equal work. Women make 79 cents for the same type of work as men make in our country. It's an outrage.
I have a 17-and-a-half-year-old daughter who wants to go out and make justice in the world. What advice do you have to her for a woman to have her voice and to make a difference?
Well, I think that she, when I was writing Speak Truth to Power, my other book, I talked to Marion Wright Edelman. Marion Wright Edelman was the first African-American to pass the bar in Mississippi, and she did that in the 1960s in order to defend civil rights activists. And she said, I was so blessed. She said, you know, everyone at some point, you have to reach into that envelope of your soul and take out that piece of paper and find out what you're supposed to be doing here on earth. And she said, I'm so blessed because I found a cause at a very young age that to me was worth dying for, and that's made every day of my life worth living. And my recommendation to a young woman who's interested in social justice is find a cause that you feel is worth dying for, that you want to put your heart and soul and every ounce of your being into, and that will make your life worth living.
I think I want to take your CCD class. You teach this every week. Is that right?
Or I have.
When
I'm
you
not
have,
teaching
you
it right
and
now.
Go. So why do you do that? What do you do during your CCD class? And why is that something that's important to you?
Okay, the truth of the reason that I do it is because I want to be with my kids. So I teach my children CCD. And what do I do? They give you a book, and they tell you what to teach, and I teach from that book.
You don't go off script at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm always talking, bringing in the social justice issues that are reflected in whatever the Bible reading for the week is, and so we definitely talk about that. My kids in the CCD class know all about the Immokalee farm workers in South Florida who, of course, have prosecuted five cases of slavery over the last decade and freed 1,000 slaves in the United States of America in Florida and South Carolina. So my kids can tell you all about that sort of thing.
Well, wonderful. We all wish that our kids were in that. We're going to be taking your questions soon, so if you do have questions, you can start lining up at the mic over to the side. And that will be coming very soon. I just wanted to pursue a couple more things before we're able to engage the audience. And one of those has to do with how much time you concern yourself with the points of theology, like, you know, trying to figure out, well, how could Christ be both God and human? And how could God have created the world and then its fall and then redeemed, and when will there be a final redemption? And, you know, how much time do you spend? Is that important to you, the whole theological framework for your belief?
I know. I love talking about those issues with my friends who are Jesuits, and then that's kind of it. I mean, I'm not sitting around at night contemplating that. I'm trying to, you know, get the dishes done and get the kids to bed and do my work and get out the next morning and sort of start the day. So I don't have the chance or make the time to really work on that. I'd like to.
when you were growing up, did you have much contact with religious folks like Dan and Phil Berrigan and Liz McAllister? Were those people that were in your world?
They in particular were not, but we had lots of, as I said, nuns and priests who were around our house all the time. And they were just heroic figures. You know, they were all involved in social justice work. In fact, my mother sort of had this, she loved the Pope. And then she loved nuns, and she was very skeptical of everybody else. And so she sort of wouldn't accept anybody into the fold until they had passed the poverty test. So she would ask, you know, what do you think about this issue? What do you think about what's happening on Indian reservations? What do you think about what's happening in El Salvador? And if they answered the questions correctly, then they were invited in, and they and they were sort of made part of our family, which was a wonderful experience for me. But so Father McSorley, for instance, was, you know, one of the, he was always at our house, and he was a hero in World War II, and Jerry Creedon, who married, I think, about 22 Kennedys, and is still one of our best friends to everybody in my family, was the hurling champion of Ireland, but a lot of people who were just working in inner city issues across our country.
Dorothy Day, did you have any contact with Dorothy Day, or
no,
is she an inspiration at all?
Well, of course she is an inspiration. I never met her, but I heard a story from Martin Sheen, as a matter of fact, that when she was in New York, two young men came into the her house that she ran there, and this is the 1950s, and sat down and just asked her sort of an hour or two of questions, and they got up and left, and they turned out to be my father and my uncle. So I like to think about that, because I think that there's so much of her vision of what it means to be Catholic and her commitment to ending, you know, to serving people who are struggling in our country is really what they were all about.
So as an author, do you have a bug to write a new book? Is there something ruminating, or are you just trying to recover from getting this book done?
No, I know. I've already started my next book.
Are you going to give us a sneak preview?
Sure. My next book is interviews with women leaders, governors, senators, heads of state, about what it means to be a woman in leadership.
Wow, that should be quite
a
book.
I'll be back.
Yeah, you'll be back. That will be terrific. You know, we're going to take some questions now. If anyone wants to speak into the mics for our worldwide radio audience, And please speak into the mic loudly, and we'll have a great opportunity to hear your comments.
Good evening, Gary. Just like you, I'm also a Catholic, raised in a Catholic schools. First of all, I would applaud your mother, a very strong woman because of her Catholic faith. I've seen how she was with your dad during the presidential campaign. Now, my question is, how did you feel right away when your grandmother Rose pardoned Sirhan Bisara Sirhan as your father's killer? Did you feel right away the grace to pardon also?
I have never heard that my grandmother pardoned Sirhan Sirhan, so that's news to me. But, you know, I think that sense of forgiveness and reconciliation is something that when I learned that my father had been had died, I went into my bedroom and I put my head in the pillow and I prayed. I prayed for him and I prayed for our family and I prayed that no one would do to him what he had done to my dad. I didn't want any other family to have to go through what we were going through, and I just didn't want that vengeance. And as an adult, I have witnessed in so many countries around the world the struggle for reconciliation. And I have spoken so often to victims of torture who, in various circumstances in different countries, have either seen their torturers prosecuted, or more often, their torturers are walking free through the streets, and how they live with that. So I think that, you know, reconciliation, forgiveness is an essential part of Catholicism, but forgiveness is too often confused with saying what happened didn't happen, or that it's okay that it happened. And I think that there's a fear of forgiveness because people are afraid that they'll become a doormat and they can be walked on if they say, I forgive you. And so we have to be clear about what we mean by forgiveness.
I apologize. I haven't actually read the book yet. I just picked it up today and then heard you were speaking here tonight. So coincidence or divine grace, probably. But in the process of your interviews, did you specifically ask their opinion as to what makes a good Catholic? Is it believing what the church tells you? Is it doing social justice? Is it going to Mass on Sundays? Did that come up at all in your interviews? What makes a good Catholic?
It's interesting that you asked that question because that term good Catholic is really so, it's so full of such fear and terror and condemnation and a sense of not being good enough by almost everybody who I interviewed. If that word was used, if that term was used, that's somebody who is feeling that they haven't quite done it. With the sole exception, again, of Tom Monahan, who expressed that he felt that he was, you know, he's living by the magisterium every day of his life and that his goal is to be in a state of grace at any given moment in case he dies and so that he can go to heaven. The one person who really addressed this issue very specifically was Bill O'Reilly. And he said, you know, I'm not a good Catholic and I struggle with it and I try, but I'm not a good Catholic.
I'd like to ask, you've mentioned in many different ways the Catholic Church as from the priest at the pulpit to the magisterium. What do you see as the role of the Catholic Church, be it either the magisterium or a priest or as a moral guide? Or what do you see the role of the Catholic Church in whatever way you want to interpret what that can mean, the Catholic Church, in our lives, in politics particularly?
Well, I think I see the role of the Catholic Church as bringing the good news of Christ to the world, and that good news consists in, as far as I can see, of that we have a loving God, and we have a God who wants justice, and that we have and that we should treat each other with respect and with recognize people's dignity, and treat each other well. I think that's the role of the Catholic Church is to announce that, is to guide people in that, is to help people see that, is to live as a demonstration of that. That's what the Catholic Church, to me, should be about, and at its best is about. And as far as politics is concerned, I think that it's important for all of us to be engaged in the political life of our country. And that a lot of people say, well, priests shouldn't get up there and talk about political issues. I completely disagree. I love it when a priest gets up and says, I'm against the death penalty. You can't vote for this guy because he's for the death penalty. I'm cheering. And, when he says things that I disagree with, okay, I disagree with it, but I'm glad he's saying it because I'm hoping people like me in the pews are going to say, I agree, I disagree, I'm going to go to the polls, I'm going, let's get engaged. My gosh, there's so much going on in this world. There's so much difficulty in our world. Let's not be passive about it. We need our leaders at every level to say to us, be engaged.
In the world that we live in, there's very few places anymore where people who are very diverse get together around a place of grace where they, the presumption is that we're accepted here, there's something greater than us. And that's a wonderful kind of element of what you're talking about, of announcing the good news that here there's some greater presence that unites us rather than divides us, even if we disagree terribly about things or fervently about things. And it's a wonderful image of the church.
Hi. I'm hearing you say that you have a very personal faith in God and that you disagree with a lot of what the church does, and I guess that means the administration. I can't understand why your faith is so related specifically to Catholicism, where there are a lot of other religions, just the Christian religions, but all kinds of other religions that also are very strong on social justice and the same kinds of basic beliefs that I think I'm hearing you talk about. So why one or not the other?
Well, it's a good question. To me, choosing a faith is not like choosing a college. It's not that you put them all out there and say, well, this is the strength of this one, this is the strength of another one. That might be for some people how they choose which faith to be involved with. But in my experience, and particularly writing this book, it became very clear that in being Catholic now that that the old adage, once a Catholic, always a Catholic, really rings true. And I think there are four or five people in this book who have claimed to have left the church years ago. And as when I asked them to be in a book called Being Catholic Now, they said, oh, yes, I'll do that. One, Gay Talese, the author, the wonderful journalist, said in my interview with him, well, I haven't been to church in 50 years. And yet, he is absolutely 100% that he's a Catholic. So, to me, why am I in it? Well, first, I feel like I'm very much a Catholic. There's a billion Catholics in the world. There's a lot of different ways of expressing our faith. And we are the people of God. We are the church. The Pope is an important element of the church. The candles are an important element of the church. The church is an important element of the church. But we're the church. We, the people, are the church. And I feel that I'm very much as much of a part of it as any nun or priest or bishop. They might not think I am, but I do.
Carrie, I think what you're speaking so much is about identity, and I've always been kind of fascinated about American Catholic identity. Just being born in the 70s, I definitely grew up post-Vatican II, post-immigrant church, but really had a sense of that from my elders before me. And I actually teach at the high school where David's son, children go to school, St. Ignatius. And frequently I'm discouraged, or I feel for my students, they're at wash with this sense of Catholic identity. What does it mean to be Catholic in the U.S. today for young people? But I have been encouraged at the same time, and I look at kind of what forms their identity, and there's two critical pieces that I've noticed. For young people, the role of grandparents, to me, has just been outstanding, like how it's shaped their faith. Parents, yes, but maybe because they're teenagers, they want to go to the grandparent. But the second two is experiences of service and justice have just shaped that. So I'm kind of curious, if you were to write a book, I mean, or maybe some of these people projected being Catholic now, what could we say or what can we project that young people might say in, I know 20 years is a short amount of time, but what might they say being Catholic now means down the road? Or what do you think it's important that they may say?
Well, I think the things that hold Catholics together, even those who have left the church, is a sense of piety, a sense of that we're living for something beyond ourselves. Now, they might say that's God, or they might say that's just behaving ethically, but that's how they live their lives, that there's a community that they are meant to serve, that we need to be informed about what's going on in the world, and a sense of connectedness. And just going back to this last question about why are you a Catholic, well, it's the way I grew up, and it's always been my faith. But also, to me, there's an important element of this, of my sense of heritage and my connection to so many women in particular in my family who have just been through such hell. I'm talking about generations ago, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 generations of women whose faith is the only thing that held them together, and they're picking those potatoes in Ireland and, you know, bringing the rain and having no hope and being abused by everybody around them. And what kept them? What was their strength? And it was really their faith, and that's important to me.
This is our last question, if there's anyone who wants to take up the challenge. Yes, if you grab the mic, we'll let you take up the challenge. That's the only tall order you have to fill.
Carrie, do you think your children ever run for public office?
That my children will? Well, I think we'd be awfully blessed if they did. Thank you.
There's certainly a lot to say for women who've been taught the kind of faith and justice and commitment that your CCD class has with your daughter. So we do hope that they go into public service. And I do want to affirm, when I look at institutions today where people can actually go and say what your identity should be is to be a being for others, service to others, a being for others, where else do we go? Really, where else do we go today? So it's easy to be cynical about the Catholic Church, to cynical about the religious community, but you know, I'd like to know what other institutions are saying to someone, think beyond yourself, above yourself, and stretch out into the world. And so I think we should celebrate those places rather than try and undermine them. So your book is such a service for that, and we want to thank you for writing your book.
Thank you.
Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Well done.